Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosie. Well, I played part one last week. I have to play part two today of my two-part epic conversation with John Krull, the host of No Limits, discussing the films of Elvis Presley, since August 16th is the anniversary of Elvis's death. And yes, McKenna Mays is back as moderator for this. Always good to hear her on the airwaves. And because of the timing of the piece, I will have to save my audio tribute to Neil Simon for next week's program. Now, last week I talked about the film Puzzle and it being a showcase for Kelly MacDonald. This week it's Emily Mortimer's turn, not her tune. This is a woman, she's going to be playing Jane Banks in Mary Poppins Returns. You've seen her in a number of things, including she was a regular on The Newsroom as Mackenzie McHale, Hugo, Shutter Island, Harry Brown, Trans-Siberian, Lars and the Real Girl, Young Adam, Bright Young Things, Dear Frankie. She was in Scream 3. Same year she was in Kenneth Branagh's Love's Labor's Lost, Ghost in the Darkness, just one of those that ladies. And she got a chance to star in a cute little independent film called The Bookshop. She plays a widow in post-World War II England, actually 1959 England, who opens up a bookshop in a quiet town, even though a lot of people don't want the bookshop there, most notably an older rich woman played by Patricia Clarkson. Bill Nighy is in this as well as a shut-in wealthy man who forms an kind of an unlikely friendship, and just a friendship, between he and the Mortimer character. One of the plot points, besides her character trying to better the town, better a child who is being who's been hired as one of her assistants. She also works at this bookstore the same time that the novel Lolita comes out, and that causes a stir amongst the town. It's a charming little picture. If you've seen charming little English pictures like this, you kind of know where it's going as far as interference and perseverance. But it's not a loud, obnoxious film, I have to say. And going into September, we're getting close to grown-up movie season, and this is a nice setup for it. So, and kudos to Emily Mortimer. It's an understated performance. And if you need a break from the post-summer blockbuster season, this is a good way to go. And it's directed and written by Isabel Coix. I hope I'm saying that right. She did Elegy with Ben Kingsley and Penelope Cruz. So The Bookshop is go look for that if you're not seeing Crazy Rich Asians. And kudos to that film for doing as well as it has been. So much so, it's even in the drive-ins now. It's at the Tibbs Drive-In. It's teamed up with Mamma Mia, of course. And then there's Happy Time Murders, Mile 22, The Meg and Slender Man, Christopher Robin, and The Incredibles 2. Yeah, and then The Incredibles 2 and Ant-Man and the Wasp are at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. A few films of note on DVD and Blu-ray. Finally got to see RBG, the documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Court cases, some of the court cases I knew, a lot of them I did not. And it's fun watching her backstory along with candid footage of her today. So very rewarding, very fun. Also good is a film called American Animals, which college kids are trying to pull off a heist of very rare and expensive books on campus. Not a dunderhead film. You would think that because of the age and the maturity of the characters, but they've studied enough heist films, and yet they still try to pull one off when they know nothing will go according to plan. Book Club is also on Blu-ray and DVD. Not as awful as I thought it would be, but you don't see that in the ad campaign. So anyway, there you go there. All right. Because August 16th was the anniversary of Elvis's death, here is part two of my Elvis chat with John Krull, the host of No Limits, moderated by McKenna Mays. Enjoy. All right, next.
1965, Girl Happy.
Elvis on spring break. Yeah. But he's not on spring break. He's on he's on duty on spring break following a mobster's daughter. This is the first of the Shelley?
Let's see. Yeah, let's see. It was Girl Happy,
Spin Out,
and then Clambake.
And Clambake, yeah. John Fiedler has a bit in this for you fans of Winnie the Pooh, the voice of Piglet, but he's the kind of nervous motel manager.
Yeah.
And this is already after Where the Boys Are and Palm Beach Holiday. I mean, all these and the kind of Frankie Nannette type stuff.
Well, and you could tell, among other things, they're beginning to struggle with what to do with the fact that that Elvis isn't 22
Correct.
Anymore. That you know, around that time he'd turned 30, and you know, it's less so now that we see the Rolling Stones continuing to do rock and roll into their 70s, and these acts performing, it's not as big a deal. But at that time,
if we were 30 and hanging out in Fort Lauderdale, there'd be a problem.
Well, and also that the whole notion of, I mean, it wasn't that far away before, you know, the Who were singing, I Hope I Die Before I Get Old. You know, it really was a concern that, you know, this was only about the kids. So I always thought, okay, you know, instead of making him the young rebel type, the threat to order and authority, we transform him into the, you know, the school chaperone now.
Right.
And, you know, that works about as well as you would anticipate.
We wish all, I'm sure a lot of ladies thought, when they wished all chaperones looked like 30-year-old Elvis.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Next.
Tickle Me.
Oh, jeez.
The only thing, and maybe because this was the first Elvis movie.
I understand.
I saw. I have a sentimental attachment to it, even though it is not a good movie.
Elvis at a dude ranch, and there's a treasure, and there's bad guys floating.
And they're all dressed in masks.
That's
and,
right.
And it's a haunted dude ranch.
So it's, you know, it's a Scooby-Doo episode, basically, before Scooby-Doo came out.
But this is one place where the Colonel's cost-cutting instincts actually, I think, helped the movie, mm-hmm. other than the fact that it probably never should have been made. But because he did not want to go to the expense of recording a new soundtrack, the soundtrack, all the songs, are taken from early 60s Elvis studio albums. So you're hearing, you know, there are several cuts from what is one of Elvis's best albums, Elvis Is Back, the
yep.
one that he recorded right after he got out of the Army. And just screams, release, I am free again, and I can do what I want. those are, you know, that makes the soundtrack. And I think that's part of what spoke to me, is because when I look at that and you look at the movies that sort of surrounded in that period, there's no comparison.
Correct. That's correct. So, yeah, I'll have to maybe give that one another shot. But I understand.
Well, the other thing is that I think the you can spare yourself the pain associated with the experience by just ordering the soundtrack album through the Follow That Dream label, so you can just hear the songs.
Very good. And I know, I think they did an Elvis's Back Deluxe Edition.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's phenomenal.
Cool.
That's
all right. Phenomenal. Next.
Harum Scarum.
Okay. Elvis on a movie set, and there's a kidnapping, and then there's songs. And that's kind of...
And he's supposed to be this movie star who's kind of like...
Who looks like this...
Rudolph Valentino.
Sure.
But because he's a sheik, at least, that's in one of the initial scenes.
Not the wrestler, the sheik.
Who somehow manages to kill a tiger with a single karate chop. And all of that, but it is, I wish I could say this was the Nader, but no,
it keeps going.
Beyond.
We're only
in
1965.
Yeah,
My story with this is I had friends at Ball State who took a history of music course taught by a man named Ralph Strobel. I guess you have to look this up, but... the last week of classes, they finally got to rock and roll. So my buddies were really excited. And then he says, we're going to listen to Elvis. And they get really excited. He plays the Harum Scarum soundtrack because Ralph Strobel apparently played oboe on the session for film. Take that.
Well,
from Shostakovich and the Elizabethan era to Harum Scarum.
And the other thing is that about... that movie, you can tell he is at some level checking out. He's not quite at the point where, in a couple of the later ones, Clambake, that we've talked about already, and Easy Come, Easy Go, if you watch closely, you can actually see him looking off to the side and reading the cue cards.
It's like a Saturday Night Live guest.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really... he'd always, at some level... tried to take the music seriously up to this point, but you can tell on several of the songs, okay. And if this stuff's now available. They have a lot of the outtakes, and you'll hear him saying things like, I literally do not know what to do with a POS like this. I just don't know how to sing it, how to make it believable.
That's not good if you're a singer.
No, not at all. So. Not at all.
Next.
1966, Frankie and Johnny.
Another disappointment.
Yeah, you had Donna Douglas. Already, for you fans of the Beverly Hillbillies, this is a film that has Harry Morgan singing.
It does. And it's one of the Jordanaires.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. But it was sort of a break from the mold because it's on a riverboat and it's supposed to be let's take the old standard Frankie and Johnny and stretch it out into a 90-minute movie, and you probably get about 60 minutes worth.
Well, and the problem is that, the whole Frankie and Johnny. The song
doesn't end well.
No, but it would have made an interesting story,
yep.
An interesting movie, because it's about betrayal, it's about expectation, and in its way, it's a story song about mature people and all of that. And instead, it's just a light and frothy costume drama
with a tagged on ending.
Yeah,
where he, spoiler alert on a 50-year-old film, but a flask keeps a bullet from hitting him. Not since the film version of Our Town, when they wake up and realize it was all a dream. I'm like, really? You're going to pull that stunt?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. No, it was. And again, you look at the places where the thing could have been turned around or resurrected. This is another one of those huge missed opportunities.
Yep. Next.
Paradise Hawaiian Style.
Okay, we already...
This is the Nader, as far as I'm concerned. This is it. This is it.
Didn't need two films set in Hawaii. Didn't need three films. Well, didn't need this. Did not need this.
Yeah.
Did you ever see the film Heaven Help Us?
No.
It's an underrated. It's from 1985, and I'll get to the film. But it's set in a Catholic school in the Bronx. Young Andrew McCarthy, young Kevin Dillon, Donald Sutherland is the head of the Brotherhood. Wallace Shawn has a cameo. John Hurd is the young kind of hip. Yeah, Mary Stuart Masterson is the girl. It's kind of advertised as a horny teenager movie, like a Animal House. It's got a lot more heart to it. But there's a scene where the Pope is riding through New York, and the four boys, young Patrick Dempsey is in it as well. They skip out and they go see Paradise Hawaiian Style, and Kevin Dillon's comment is he finally lights up a cigarette in the theater and looks at the screen and says, "What'd they do to Elvis? Cut his balls off?"
Yeah.
And that's, well, literally and figuratively, I guess, and more figuratively. So.
Well, and it's, I mean, let me put it this way. In one of the songs in there, and there are several Elvis contributions to Hell's Top 40.
we'll have that list for another show.
Yeah, but A Dog's Life is certainly there. And I think the thing that is so disappointing about it is you could tell even with that soundtrack, though, that he's trying new vocal approaches, anything to try to make it work. If there's anything that has even a modicum of a value to it, you know, there's a much fuller sound to his voice and all of that. You could tell he had done some extensive training and all of that, and you think, oh God, all that effort, for something that is, would have to improve considerably to be awful. So, yeah.
And these are quotes you won't see in the ad campaigns. Yeah,
no.
Next.
Spin Out.
Okay, another racing film, Elvis with Three Girls. Somebody has told, actually, somebody who works here, the theory was that somebody tried to make a spoof of an Elvis movie, and that this was it, but it wound up being played straight. Have you heard this?
I have not heard that.
Okay.
But, it's, again,
race car driver, three girls to choose
now,
from.
Now, the one thing I will say is, it was a shorter soundtrack for the film. And every movie, with a few exceptions, had an album associated with it released. And even when he wasn't selling at the 1950s level, he was still selling at 200,000-250,000 albums for even some that weren't particularly good, the soundtracks. This one, to flesh it out, to get it to album length, they added what they called bonus songs, which became a new thing.
Yep.
But in this case, there is an absolutely exquisite cover of Bob Dylan's Tomorrow is a Long Time.
Right.
That is just, it's 5.5 minutes long, and just this really, really lovely rendering of that song. He does I'll Remember You for the first time. He's recorded that, and this is at a time you can tell the guy is almost desperate to get back into the studio and do something that has some meaning instead of all of this.
Wasn't this film that had Do the Clam?
No, that's Girl Happy.
Oh, I stand
corrected. That's another one of Hell's Top 40.
Written by, was it Dolores Taylor, for you Ed Wood fans out
now,
there?
No, I hate to tell you this, but even as bad as some of those songs are, some of the songs, they still are not going to knock Billy Don't Be a Hero out of the number one spot.
I'm gonna get John Kroll's Hell's Top 40 okay. later, but that's fun. All right. Next.
1967, Easy Come, Easy Go.
Okay, so going after sunken treasure, former Navy guy, Pat Harrington is your comedic sidekick.
And renders good service.
Yep, there. And Pat Priest in a bikini for you fans of the Munsters.
Yeah,
and of all things, I think one of the final performances from Elsa Lanchester as a This was also a film that this was a major studio that was this was that time where you started to poke fun at the counterculture.
Well,
and they do that in this.
Yeah, and some of it is also, again, you look at this in the context of what was going on in Elvis's life. It's a time. This is a guy who was who, you know. The perception of him is that he was just sort of this, you know, unconscious artist, that he didn't think through anything or any. And, you know, if you listen to the recording sessions and the kind of choices and the fact that almost inevitably, he was producing his own sessions from the beginning, you know, basically from the moment he left Sam Phillips down in Memphis till the day he died, he produced his own sessions. But he knew he was lost. He knew he was adrift. He had turned increasingly toward Eastern religions and alternative lifestyles. He, you know, and was really on this spiritual quest, and had begun dabbling in yoga. And another one of Hill's top 40
yoga
here.
Yoga is as yoga does.
Yoga is as yoga does, which is designed to insult that whole movement. And you know, I mean, he looks incredibly uncomfortable while he's doing. It not just because it's being played for comedy, but he was smart enough to know that he was being insulted at that point.
There's a scene of body painting, you know, girls in bikinis being rolled in paint and rolled. Yeah, because that was the big studio's impression of the counterculture. You know, not, you know, because making fun of Dobie Gill, you know, the beatniks of the 50s and the hippies of the 60s. Well, they're easy fodder when you're a big studio, even though the studios were starting to crumble at this time.
Yeah.
Next.
Double Trouble.
Okay. Elvis in Danger. Don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Elvis in Europe. Not in Europe. In the MGM, the Universal MGM UA lot. But not a film that's going to age even more so in the Me Too movement, because you have Elvis teamed up with a 17-year-old girl.
Well,
and
the actress was not 17.
No, but the character. The character
is supposed to be 17.
And the running bit is they keep waiting for her to turn 18. Ugh. And General Burkhalter and Michael Murphy are in this film.
Even though he is, you know, they've set it up so that, you know, and this is... again, sort of about the neutering of Elvis Presley on film too. You know, the Annette O'Day, who was the actress,
correct,
is sexually the aggressor all the way through the movie, which you could tell that they were queasy about this even to begin with, although it's odd. I mean, to some degree, what was going on in Elvis's life was that he was waiting? He was waiting for Priscilla to get old enough so he could marry her.
So this is Elvis's version of Charade,
yes,
or Walk, Don't Run.
Yeah,
and he's not Gary Grant.
But you know, and it might have been workable if it just,
This film also features him singing "Old MacDonald."
Oh yes, yes.
Oh, top 41.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, and you can tell that they don't. I mean. The traditional sort of Tin Pan Alley songwriters they were going for, the professionals, you could tell even then at that point, up until this point, you know, musicals by and large often, you know, the ones that weren't taken from Broadway musicals or weren't conscious artistic things would have filler songs in them, or things that weren't, but they were well-crafted. Elvis's early films, even if the songs were not great, you could tell there was at least a level of professional craftsmanship there. The big, what is supposed to be the showstopper song here, is Long-Legged Girl with a short dress on that clocks in at like a minute and 20 seconds. You could tell, okay, I wrote a verse. I'm done. Give me my check. You know, I fulfilled my obligation.
No 3-hour musicals in the Elvis canon at all.
No.
Next.
Clam Bake.
Okay. Race. Bill Bixby is your foil. And my daughter, when she was younger, this was her favorite because it was her first time of seeing Elvis sing the children.
Yeah.
And that's really about it.
Which is unfortunate because that may be the single worst Elvis sings to children song. Yeah. I mean, the song is called Confidence, oh, yeah. Which is supposed to be kind of Elvis's answer to Frank Sinatra's High Hopes. But it's like he spells it out, goes C-O-M-F-I-D, and then at the end of the song, it's like, oh, you can tell the songwriters decided, I can't make anything else work with this, with the rhythm scheme or rhyming or anything like that, so we're just going to say, Ants.
Yeah.
And he moves on. And it is truly atrocious. But again, and this is even in the worst films, you see these moments, and this, by the way, I think is one of the worst.
Yeah.
You know, I've already referenced the mountains in Florida and all of that. And he sings another song about goop.
Yeah.
In there, which has to be seen to be believed. But then there is just this absolutely exquisite rendering of, you know, song made famous by Eddie Arnold and Ray Charles, You Don't Know Me.
Yep.
That, you know, is sublime. And the fact that it is in this, you know,
not chicken salad,
mountain of feces is what makes it, you know, all the more moving.
It's Steve Carlton winning a Cy Young with the 72 Phillies.
Yeah.
27 victories, 62 wins as a whole.
Yeah.
So there you go. Next.
1968, Stay Away, Joe.
Okay. we said earlier about Elvis playing a half-breed and Flaming Star, and this is in the time-honored tradition of your this is not at the Idle Jorg. This is your great cinematic Native American characters, Burt Lancaster, Paul Newman, Martin Landau, Chuck Connors. This is bad.
Oh,
and it's Burgess Meredith and Joan Blondell, and it's
there's a lot of talent wasted.
Yeah,
in this movie.
It's supposed to be a rollicking hell. I believe the subhead for the poster was he doesn't say how, he says when. It's that, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, and Elvis is supposed to be this hustler. You can tell they are trying to move him toward
something,
a more adult kind of screen presence. Because Joan Blondell's character, there are allusions in the film that her character and Elvis had a relationship earlier on. Now Elvis is kind of chasing after her daughter, which creates some disquieting elements and all of that, but that she was the older woman in his life. It's maddening. It's odd. A few years ago with my family, we were on vacation in Sedona where it was shot. And,
did you take the tour?
Well, no, but it's we took a tour of Sedona, one of the pink Jeep tours that they do where the big thing is that they'll run you up these really steep climbs on the thing because they've worked it out, and if it's less than four. But, you know, the guy's pointing out and say, you know, talks about the movies that have been shot in the area, and one of them he pointed out to, like, this butte and said, yeah, that if you watch the movie Stay Away, Joe, there's a very young Elvis singing up there. And I needed to say, well, no, he really wasn't singing. He was lip-syncing at that point. But getting the recording equipment up there might have been a little tough. So another thing where there could have been a possibility of an interesting story there. Scenery is gorgeous. I mean, it's an incredible setting. Yeah.
And it was another one where it wasn't quite the same film three times a year. It was something slightly different.
Well, and you could tell he was trying to break out and play a character who at least was somewhat closer to his age, too.
Yes. I always remember
he was in his early 30s at that point.
This year, of course, marked the 50th anniversary of the big explosion in downtown Richmond.
Yeah.
And this was the film that was playing in the theater at time of the explosion. We learned this through the Wayne County Historical Society. But my wife was my wife teaches theater at Earlham. She was she was helping out with a one act about that day. And I get the call from my wife going, do you have the sound? Do you have the soundtrack to Stay Away, Joe?
Oh.
I said, I have the song because there's the myriad of movie compilations. Yeah. I actually have the title track. I'll bring it in. So, you know, there's something out of that. I also remember Elvis got a nomination in the Golden Turkey Awards, written by the Medved brothers of worst. I'm going to forget the category, but it's worst
racial stereotype. Or Indian or something.
He's up against Chicano actor Robbie Benson in Walk Proud. And, of course, the winner was Marlon Brando in Tea House on the August Moon. That's hard to top. So
it's been so long. This is not one of the films I have seen more than once, I think. Once was enough. But... You know, I know with this, you know, he did the sort of peppy Stay Away Joe title track.
Yep.
But then there was an alternate version, Stay Away, that is done to Greensleeves that, again, is lovely. And you think, oh, you know, it's like consistently the people who were handling him, you could see. Whenever we come to the fork in the road, let's choose the one that can do the most damage to this guy's aspirations and his dreams and all of that. And I'm not relieving him of responsibility because he was a grown man.
Shot TVs. He could have done something.
You can make an argument that he was the most single most powerful figure in entertainment for a period of time. I mean, the Beatles, at least during the '60s. I mean, we overlook it. We think of him as a huge 50s act, but he actually was the second biggest record seller in the 60s, too, behind the Beatles.
He just didn't have the rights to his own music until 1973.
Well, actually, no. It's worse than that.
Oh, worse than that?
He owned the rights. The Colonel sold them for a one-time payment, and then there was litigation after that.
There you go.
Yeah.
And the hits just keep on coming.
Yep.
Next.
Speedway.
Okay,
real attempt here.
Because, and I say no more races. However, Nancy Sinatra is not Anne Margaret, but she does
closest
have a little,
he's got.
Yeah, the closest sense.
And Bill Bixby.
And Bill Bixby is this time comedic sidekick as opposed to smarmy foil.
And Gail Gordon.
That's right. And
William Shaller.
Thank you. Yes, with the carload of kids for him to sing to.
And probably the one exception to the Elvis should not sing to children rule.
That one
is, he does a lovely for anyone who's the father of a daughter.
Yep.
Your time hasn't come yet, baby. Has a real kind of emotional resonance
when
he and Nancy Sinatra sing a couple of duets. You could tell there's some sparks there.
Yep.
Let Yourself Go is a powerful performance.
Yeah, that's the first. I think there was a couple of them. I believe, club owner Carl Ballantyne
doing the
spotlight when somebody, when a celebrity shows up into a club, they are forced to sing because they are famous. So, and that happens in this one. But dear IRS, make more agents look like Nancy Sinatra.
Oh, yeah, that's, speaking before we move on, we got to add another one.
Yes.
To Hell's Top 40. He's your uncle, not your dad.
People are going to YouTube frantically now with this Spotify Hades list. Yeah. So, next.
Live a little, love a little.
Okay. I use the term with the romantic. There are certain, I call them psychotic romantic comedies. The Rock Hudson Doris Day stuff, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, My Best Friend's Wedding. If normal-looking people acted the way people acted in those, you would need a restraining order. But because it's Julia Roberts and Matthew McConaughey, there's a woman that keeps him trapped in a house and in the water for 3 days
and costs him his job.
And there was also, this might have been the origin of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah.
The same year was Sandy Dennis in Sweet November, where she kind of takes over Anthony Newley's life in the same way.
Yeah, and I've got to say, this film...
Michelle Carey.
And Dick Sargent is in it.
Dick Sargent's in it, yep. And go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to think who the... Well, anyhow, what's interesting is this is a film where you get the sense if they had had more time...
Mm-hmm.
they might actually have been able, because the first like half an hour, 40 minutes of it, well, I find it, it's got a real kind of loopy charm.
I think, and they could have sliced it in half.
And all of that, but then you could just see, it's like, okay, the writers did not know where to go with it. And of course, shoehorning the songs in, which was increasingly becoming an imperative.
And I think if you take the songs out, and I mean, I love Edge of Reality, even though it's a weird dream sequence, and
a little less conversation.
Hello, fans of Ocean's 11, that's the remix. You take those out, it's a Tony Curtis film.
It is in a lot of ways. Tony Curtis was one of Elvis's early idols, too.
Right, and this is because this is the kind of lightweight romantic comedy that Curtis was stuck in until The Boston Strangler.
Yeah.
So this one, it's okay. And then, yeah, there's...
You mean Boston Strangler was not a lightweight romantic comedy?
It depends on who you talk to, really.
Okay.
But yeah, there's also... He winds up getting the two jobs.
I didn't sleep for 2 years after seeing that movie, so... That was a joke, folks.
That's over Boston Strangler. But yeah, there's a magazine that's not Playboy, and then there's another magazine that's not Vogue.
Oh, Rudy Valley which is a reference, you know. That.
So it's he's older. He's not 20. He's not 25.
But the other thing that, and also there is, for the first time, I think, in Elvis films, a real attempt to deal with the question of sex, you know, in a way that is not, to use the cliche from film criticism and all of the other movies, it's like they could have been made in the 1940s where the kiss is the climax.
Correct.
In this one, you have Elvis and his leading lady sharing a bed. Now, again, using the sort of 40-style conventions, they have a board separating them.
Thank you. It happened one night.
And she makes, there's even some comedic byplay where, she says she got a splinter and he says, that's what you get for trying to climb fences. and all of that. But then there is a moment when they have resolved their differences and it looks like there's going to be a romance where the board gets thrown away and it's clear. Okay, the kiss is not going to be the climax this time.
And sometimes a board is just a piece of wood.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Next.
1969, Charo.
The spaghetti western attempt in the United States.
Yeah. It's
okay.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's different. If anything, I think there was that kind of relief of, if you've been starving and you get a Ritz, I guess it's the best Ritz cracker, but after it's not, this comes after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and the way and Django and the wave of Italian westerns, and they tried to make one in the United States.
Yeah, and the direction is basic to, that's about the best you can say about that. Again, you get a sense the guy is trying.
Yes.
Victor French is in it, and, by the time he's done, there's not a piece of scenery left standing within a 200-mile radius. The man must have been really hungry before he came to work.
I wish, maybe not Sergio Carbucci maybe Burt Kennedy or somebody else who would have done Western, maybe more Westerns.
Yeah, because it's also around the time that, James Garner was doing those delightful
spoofs.
Yep. Support your local gunfighter, support your local sheriff, that were still hilarious. Yeah.
Scalp hunters, so all of them. Yeah. So almost. Next.
The Trouble with Girls.
Odd one. And it's
really
different.
Strange.
And it's set in a Chautauqua. And Elvis is the head of the Chautauqua. I believe he only has one number, clean up your own backyard. But there's a couple of
Well, they do. He sings in the sort of gospel thing, too. Sweet Chariot and all of that.
That's true. But there's, Vincent Price has a cameo. And there's a young Dabney Coleman. And there's kids. And, I mean, it's this kind
Sherry North.
Sherry North, that's right. But there's this almost ensemble piece, but it doesn't really connect as an ensemble for the most part.
There's an attempt to sort of mature it. I mean, at one point, they're having a discussion where there's a sense of reproachment, and he's rubbing her shoulders and suggests maybe we should continue this conversation, somewhere else.
With a block of wood.
Yeah. Or not.
Or not.
Yeah. But again, it's like all the detail. They make some attempts to make it a 1920s period piece and all of that. And yet he shows up in a cream white suit with flaring, flaring pant legs.
Shellacked hair.
Well, shellacked hair and, and the return of the mutton chops. Sideburns and all of that. And, it's like, again, if you're going to do it, commit to it.
There's a great that same year in the commentary track for True Grit.
Yeah.
There's a film historian and the Western historian. And I always remember on Glenn Campbell's first entrance, you hear the Western historian go, yeah, that's a Western haircut.
Yeah.
It's just. Ugh.
Well, and what I hope we're going to talk about Might Have Been's, because apparently that was the Glenn Campbell part was one that Elvis was considered for.
Man, that's a good what could have.
Yeah. So
we'll get to those.
Yep.
Next.
Change of habit.
All right. This is currently my daughter's favorite. Mm-hmm. It is Mary Tyler Moore as everyone's favorite undercover nun. So
Barbara McNair.
Barbara McNair as well. But it's Universal's attempt to look at a serious look at the counterculture. You have Ed Asner as a racist sheriff, racist police
officer.
Well,
actually, no, he's understanding. It's the man, the banker, who is the evil guy.
This is why John is here, folks.
Yeah.
Shot on the Universal lot. Everyone's favorite ghetto doctor, Dr. John Carpenter, who, of course, directed Elvis, the miniseries with Kurt Russell.
Yeah, he's an incredibly expensively dressed ghetto doctor, too, which, just adds to the ambiance of the experience.
My daughter and I, our favorite moment, and this is we dedicate this to Jenny McCarthy, is the little girl who has autism, and Elvis is going to hold her and hold her and love her until all the autism is run out of her.
Yes, it is. That scene is both painful and hypnotic to watch.
It goes on. It does go on.
It's pretty much a masochist dream, I think. It's
like Costner at the end of Tin Cup.
It's really, really, but again, there are moments there.
I love the title track.
I do too.
Let Us Pray is not a bad way to end a film.
But again, and this is one of those things, it falls into the John Lennon category of, we're bigger than Jesus kind of thing. Because if you watch that, and again, spoiler alert for a movie that's almost 50 years old here, at the end of the movie, Mary Tyler Moore has returned to the convent. But she is really, really troubled because she has developed feelings for Elvis's character. And
the ultimate love triangle.
The mother superior says, you're never going to be clear on your heart unless you meet with this man again and come. And so she goes to see Elvis performing, sort of a rock mass at the Catholic church. And the whole thing is set in New York, by the way. And the final scene, I kid you not, is Mary Tyler Moore, torn. She's looking at Elvis singing Let Us Pray, and then they cut to images of Jesus, Elvis, Jesus, Elvis, Jesus. And, at the end of the day, that's it. It's like the level of comparison. Yep. I suspect the only reason that did not become a source of controversy at the time is very few people saw it.
Yeah.
So, in part because of what was going on with his career, outside of the movies, he was doing much more interesting stuff.
Yeah, and Easy Rider was in theaters, and this.
Oh yeah.
This was the Universal trying to do the counterculture. There's two guys who are so not the Black Panthers, and there's almost a riot on the Universal lot.
The
rapist guy who goes after Mary Tyler Moore.
The African American actors there were like right out of Hollywood Shuffle.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. It was.
It's rough, but yeah. pretty good couple songs, yeah. like Mary Tyler Moore and the weird love triangle.
Mary Tyler Moore and Elvis actually had quite a bit of chemistry, yep. I thought. That worked, and the scenes with Ed Asner just popped. I mean, you could see, and apparently that's how he came to be cast on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, because they filmed that right before they started production on the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you can thank your Saturday night CBS Fest, a part of it, because of Change of Habit.
That's it.
Now, McKenna, I know there's two that are not on there because they are documentaries, but the following year we had, from 1970, Elvis, That's the Way It Is, which there are two. There is the regular theatrical version, and then when it came out on DVD, there was a director's cut. And it's about Elvis rehearsing with his band, well, with his band and the orchestra, his Vegas residency at the International. So he'd already done the 68 special. He had already started doing Vegas shows, if I remember correctly, or
he'd started in 69, okay. and then he came back in February of 70, and I think they filmed in the summer of 70.
So we see the rehearsal process, which I don't think had been captured in a music documentary at this time. So when my daughter, at the height of her Hannah Montana phase, this was very enlightening for her because, well, if you see shows, especially sitcoms about rock bands, you don't see a whole lot of rehearsal. You see the aftermath of the rehearsal.
Yeah.
And the fact is, you know, the first half of the film is working on these songs, you know, bantering amongst one another. In the director's cut, they take out kind of the infomercial for the hotel.
Yeah.
And then the second half is the performance, which 1970 Elvis with the jumpsuit, with the covers, still pretty fun.
Oh,
to watch.
Yeah. Well, and some of it is, you could tell. I mean, he did look like a man who had been released at that point. You know, and even the covers were great. I mean, the versions that he did of Creedence Clearwater's Proud Mary, you know.
You Gave Me a Mountain.
Really powerful. That comes a little later, but, you know, are just really, and you can tell, again, there's this reverence for what came before and the versions, but he makes them into something else. You know, the showstopper for that film, for that stand in Vegas, was his cover of the Righteous Brothers' You've Lost That Love and Feeling.
Yep.
And that's a really powerful moment. And whichever version of the documentary you see. But, you know, it bears little resemblance to the one that Bobby Hatfield and Bill Medley did.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, you know, theirs was kind of a call and response thing. A classic soul thing, and his is just something else altogether.
Correct. And I think it always reminds me of when you see stand-up comics make the transition from film, and we talk Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, anybody else, that most of the time you would only get, sadly, maybe 10 or 20% of what they're actually capable of. And that's kind of like this, watching this film, is that after a decade of, you know, hits and misses and near hits and everything, that he finally gets back to what he wants to do and lets loose.
Yeah.
No matter what the song choices were, and it was just fun to watch.
Well, and most of at that point the song choices, because he was still riding high. I mean, he'd done the 68 comeback special, which we've talked about, and then he went into American Studios and worked with Chips Moman, and probably came up with the single best album he ever did from Elvis in Memphis, and then they had enough cuts left over for another great album called Back in Memphis.
Yep.
But again, you get into the whole marketing strategy thing. You know, they've got this superb studio album, and you know, left the second part of the Memphis sessions, and his Vegas opening in 69. That I gather, you know, he was completely wild and uninhibited. He was all over the stage and all of that. And the Colonel figures, okay, maybe we could milk these both. And he releases them as a completely incoherent double album. You've got the live show completely truncated, a lot of the songs taken out. And then Back in Memphis as sort of the second thing, but there's no thematic coherence or anything like that. nothing about what he might have been trying to do there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
This also led to 200 to 250 shows a year.
Oh, yeah. And which ultimately, you know,
killed him.
Killed him, yeah. And all of that, because the performances, you can tell That's the way it is. He's still really alive and in tune. The recording sessions are still really, really strong, even though, once again, he has tremendous success with Chips Moman. And, of course, the Colonel's answer is, let's not have him work with Chips Moman ever again.
And finally, in the filmography section, 1972's Elvis on Tour, a cinematic postcard, souvenir, I guess, of what Elvis was doing in the early 70s on the road.
It is. Well, you can see also kind of the disintegration, what was happening to him. Because there's a reference at the beginning that says that, the 1972 presidential primaries are going on. The comic makes that, which means then that it's being shot maybe a year and a half, not quite a year and a half, after That's the Way It Is. But he looks at least 5 or 6 years older at that point.
It's also count the jumpsuits.
Yeah, and you can count, you can see the fatigue and so, and, you know, even if the arrangements are much stepped up and much more hurried of some of the old hits in That's the Way It Is, at least he's delivering them with conviction. And you can tell, by this point, because he's been on the road for so long, it's like, okay, I'm going to get through Don't Be Cruel for, the 556th time I've sung it in the past 6 months, so I can get to this new song that I really want to do.
Yep. And it was Martin Scorsese was one of the montage editors on this film.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
Documentary nomination, if I remember.
Yeah, it was, and you know, and it is a revealing slice. I mean, there are moving moments, like, you know, they capture him retreating upstairs and just singing gospel.
Yep.
And again, you can just see the kind of release for the guy that he's out from under it for a little while.
Yep. So that's the film, that's the Elvis filmography, and you alluded to one, I guess, the bigger What Could Have Been. You mentioned True Grit. What about A Star Is Born?
Yeah, well, that's the big one, because that would have come near the end of his life.
Yep.
And at least the story is that Barbara Streisand and her then domestic partner, John Peters, came to see him, and Elvis and one of his buddies, Jerry Schelling, stepped into a closet in his dressing room so that everybody else would. And they pitched the story to him. He got really, really excited about it and wanted to do it. The Colonel saw that as a threat. To be fair, there probably were some doubts about whether Elvis and Barbara Streisand could have worked together effectively.
We heard you breathe, McKenna.
Yeah. Yeah. On the other hand, for those who are not familiar with the story, it is about a huge star who becomes involved with a younger woman who then begins her rise to become a star as his is falling. And you know, it's sort of a doomed love story. Elvis would have been the older star whose star would have been. He was not the star whose star was going to be born as part.
No,
of,
that is correct. So he would.
And one of the problems with the Streisand version of the film, it had been done a couple of times before. Yeah. I always thought was, I just never believed that Kris Kristofferson was on his way down.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting to see if Elvis could have pulled that off at that stage of, and would have been willing to expose, because apparently he had very, very real fears at that time that the music world, the entertainment world, were leaving him behind.
Weren't there stories like by 1974, this is after the Aloha, the Hawaii broadcast, that when the weight started to show that he, there were some shows he didn't want to be photographed. Is that right?
Yeah, I heard that, although it's interesting, and it shows that sort of cliche in our business, how much weight the camera adds.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go to Graceland, and yes, I have been to Graceland, and they have a lot of, you know, the outfits, the jumpsuits, the stage outfits he wore. And one of the things that is shocking is you get to the stuff like the famous gold sun, the one that he wore here in Indianapolis for the last show. When we think that he, you know, was just almost, you know, morbidly obese or whatever, and look at that, and I'd say 90% of American men, there's no way they could slide into that thing. And, you know, which makes you realize, A, in the days, you know, like for the 68 TV special, when, you know, all leather, and he's so thin that he had cheekbones you could shave with, you know, and all of that, that he must have just been a toothpick at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I, you know, we, that was before the famous food story started to bubble up to the surface.
Well, the fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches, and you realize, you know, I think someone did that and calculated the calories in just one of those.
Oh, God.
And each one of them was like 1,600 calories. So you realize, you know, two of those and you're...
you're a nap.
Yeah.
So you, and you mentioned True Grit. Were there other offers that
there were whispers that at one point they were kind of looking at him for the John Voight part, Midnight Cowboy, which would have been really interesting. Now, whether, you know, as a good Southern boy from a religious background, he could have played a gay hustler, you know, is an interesting question. And at in one of its many iterations, his name was associated with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I don't think seriously. It's sort of like, because
Burt Reynolds being considered for James Bond.
Yeah, they that screenplay bounced around and the concept bounced around for so long that there was that. But, you know, I mean, at one point he was also being considered for West Side Story, which, you know, might have been an interesting choice too, and certainly forced him to think more seriously about what he was doing on film.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. That's the entire filmography. McKenna, you've been scribbling notes furiously on where to start, where not to start. So they're all available. Go take a look. But yeah, there's some fun stuff, and there's some bad stuff, and there's some good, and there's some bad, and there's some ugly.
Yeah.
You just have to figure that out, I think, for yourselves.
And if you want to, just go out there and reconstruct Hale's top 40 for yourself.
We're getting you back on the show for that.
All right.
John, thank you so much.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks again to John Krall and McKenna Mays for that very fun two-part series. Two other films of note that have been released by Film Movement, two French films, and these are two films, if you've never seen storylines like this, then you'll probably enjoy it more than I did. One is called The Three-Way Wedding, which is a love, not even a love, but a lust triangle between a playwright, his leading lady, his leading man, and his assistant. And if you've not seen Mamet or Boghossian films or even films about filmmaking or the creative process, or Edward Albee stories for that matter, you might enjoy that more than I did. And then the erotic thriller You Will Be Mine, a French film that set in a piano conservatory, a girl from the country moves into the city with a roommate, and the roommate has other ideas for her roomie. And sometimes it is good and sometimes it isn't. It doesn't quite fall deep into single white female territory, but it comes pretty close. Just reminds you, you think about your worst roommate and maybe you didn't have it so bad after all. Anyway, those are both available via Film Movement. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people, Zardoz is spoken. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Pull the string! Pull the string!
No. That's not what I said.
Shut up! My God! You have no freaking life!
All right, on that note, you're watching Film Sociology.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Otto, don't flatter yourself. It wasn't that great.
Wow, that'd be some good film in there, Mr. Soci.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!